The New York City Police Department fires the officer who killed Eric Garner with a banned chokehold in 2014. Today is Tuesday, August 20th. This is WBUR's Morning Edition. Good morning, I'm Bob Oakes. Coming up, police union criticism of the officer's firing and Garner's death. On the other side, New York Mayor Bill de Blasio.
Today will not bring Eric Garner back, but I hope it brings some small measure of closure and peace to the Garner family.
Also this hour, Facebook and Twitter suspend accounts they say were used by the Chinese government to spread misinformation in Hong Kong. And how in parts of Massachusetts there are still large numbers of people without health insurance.
In those areas where there's highest rates and highest densities of uninsurance, nearly one quarter of the families have incomes below the federal poverty level.
Forecast sunny 80s today. It's 7:01. Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A new poll suggests most Americans support red flag laws as a way to curb gun violence in the U.S. From member station KUNC in Greeley, Colorado, Lee Patterson has more.
This type of law allows family members or law enforcement to ask a judge to have firearms removed from someone in crisis. A national survey from the APM Research Lab found high levels of support, including more than 60% of gun owners. Amy Swearer is a senior legal policy analyst with the conservative-leaning Heritage Foundation.
These laws kind of give another avenue of intervening in those instances before these people act on those signs of dangerousness.
Around a quarter of respondents oppose these measures. Opposition is highest in southern and western states. For NPR News, I'm Lee Patterson in Greeley.
More than 1,000 Google employees are demanding that their company promise publicly that it won't work with immigration agencies such as the U.S. Border Protection Service. NPR's Arti Shahani says the agencies are looking for cloud providers.
CBP collects extensive data, including biometrics, on millions of people who come in and out of the U.S. It would be a very lucrative contract, but many rank-and-file Googlers say they don't want their company applying for the job. They're critical of Trump's immigration track record, imprisoning asylum seekers, separating migrant children from their parents, the alleged death of children in custody, as well as sexual abuse. Google hasn't responded to the employees' petition yet.
Google is a financial supporter of NPR. Hong Kong's chief executive says she is setting up a communication method to work to resolve differences in her city. Carrie Lam also says she'll create a fact-finding commission to study the cause of recent massive protests and police response. Protesters in Hong Kong are not happy, saying it's a waste of time. They claim Lam won't respond to their demands for more open democracy. An international monitoring group says several radiation detectors in Russia have apparently gone offline. As NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports, the mysterious outages follow a failed test of a new type of nuclear missile.
The prototype missile exploded on August 8th at a test site in northern Russia, killing at least five who were working on the project. Local radiation monitors registered a spike shortly after it happened. 2 days later, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Organization, which runs a global network of radiation detectors, says two of its stations in Russia went dark. On August 13th, two more stations in Russia went down. All four stations remain offline, according to a spokesperson for the organization. In an interview, Russian President Vladimir Putin said the accident had not caused any increase in radiation levels. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes in Boston. Massachusetts has the highest rate of citizens with health insurance in the U.S., but there are still hotspots of uninsured residents across the state. WBUR's Martha Biebinger has more on a new report out this morning from the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts Foundation.
The hotspots include Boston and adjacent communities, as well as Plymouth and Wellfleet. Foundation President Audrey Shelto says these areas have high housing costs and concentrations of young, low-income adults or non-citizens who don't qualify for subsidized insurance.
We'll never get to 100% because some people will not be eligible, but we should aim for as high as we can get.
Shelto says the report will help target efforts to enroll residents who are eligible. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Martha Biebinger.
Town of Southborough is closing all town-owned properties from dusk to dawn to reduce the risk of mosquito-borne eastern equine encephalitis, EEE. State health officials say Southborough and six other communities are at critical risk for the disease. Two human cases of EEE have been confirmed in the towns of Plymouth and Grafton. Boston Public School officials say they'll work with the MBTA to accommodate up to 10,000 more students taking trains to and from school beginning next month. The new school superintendent, Brenda Casilius, says the free T program will benefit students. But some Boston city councilors tell the Boston Herald they're concerned the T will struggle to handle the increased passenger load. The Essex County District Attorney's Office is investigating the stabbing death of a homeless man in Lynn. It says Lynn police found the man yesterday afternoon. He was brought to a hospital where he died. His name has not been released, and so far, no arrests. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Adelaide of Newton Center, a mind and memory community, with a talk on solutions for challenges in brain health August 28th, AdelaideRSVP.com. The International Association of Privacy Professionals, helping inform, train, and certify professionals to tackle privacy's toughest issues at IAPP.org. And iDrive, maker of remote PC, providing real-time remote access to PCs, Macs, and servers from anywhere for use when telecommuting or for remote management. Learn more at remotepc.com/NPR.
Sports: Red Sox and the Philadelphia Phillies begin a two-game series tonight at Fenway. The Red Sox learned yesterday that starting pitcher Chris Sale will likely not need surgery on his pitching elbow, but he's also likely done for the season. Traffic: 128 south in Linfield, there's a crash at Walnut Street. The Masspike eastbound is slow from Route 9 to the supermarket overpass in Newton. And Route 1 south, 25 minutes now from the Revere Beach Parkway to the Zakim Bridge. Forecast: should be a beautiful day today. Sunny in the mid-80s in Boston and inland, just a few degrees cooler on the Cape and the islands. Tonight it falls to the 60s. Could be stormy tomorrow with showers and possible downpours and thunderstorms. Low 80s Wednesday. Some sun on Thursday, but thunder is still possible in the 80s. Then sunny and dry and in the 70s Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. In Boston now, 72 degrees, 62 in Worcester, 67 degrees in Peabody, and on the Cape, 71 in Hyannis at 7:07.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King. Good morning. The New York Police Department yesterday fired Daniel Pantaleo, the officer who put Eric Garner in a chokehold. That chokehold triggered an asthma attack, which ultimately killed Garner. Garner had resisted arrest for allegedly selling single untaxed cigarettes. Police Commissioner James O'Neill announced the firing yesterday, and he said he has sympathy for both the Garner family and also Pantaleo.
A man with family lost his life, and that is an irreversible tragedy. And a hardworking police officer with a family, a man who took this job to do good, to make a difference in his home community, has now lost his chosen career. And that is a different kind of tragedy.
All right, in just a minute, we'll talk to Paul Butler. He's a legal scholar, and we're going to ask him whether this is justice for Eric Garner's family. But first, Cindy Rodriguez is a reporter at member station WNYC. She's joining us on Skype. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning, Noel.
I know you've been following this story carefully and closely. Has Daniel Pantaleo said anything since he was fired?
Well, Noel, only through his lawyer, Stuart London, who said that his client was disappointed but remained strong. And he also said that Officer Pantaleo plans to sue the city to get his job back. London argued that the firing was blatantly political, and he called the decision arbitrary and capricious.
Do we have any idea about whether a lawsuit could win Pantaleo his job back?
Well, it's hard to tell at this point, but what we do know is that the union has been very aggressively backing Officer Pantaleo, who at the time of Garner's death had 8 years on the force. They accuse the mayor of influencing the police commissioner's decision, and I'm sure they'll continue to keep pushing that message. On the other hand, the mayor says the process was fair and a judge made an objective decision that was based on the facts that were brought out during the officer's disciplinary trial. And, you know, Officer Pantaleo was fired because he used an illegal chokehold. And as we know, there is a video that showed what happened. And there's also an autopsy report that shows deep bruising and hemorrhaging around Mr. Garner's neck.
You mentioned Mayor Bill de Blasio. Ultimately, this, of course, was not his decision. He is running for president. How do people in New York City think he handled this situation?
Well, that's right. The mayor is running for president. And protesters, you know, you might remember, followed him to Detroit, for instance, and screamed "Fire Pantaleo" during the debates. They and the Garner family feel like it took way too long for the city to act. They were very frustrated by the process. The mayor said he had to wait for criminal investigations to play out. And then there are the supporters of the police who feel like police are put in very difficult situations and then get punished for their actions.
Cindy Rodriguez, a reporter at member station WNYC in New York. I want to bring in Paul Butler, who's a law professor at Georgetown University and author of the book Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
So one of the big questions everyone was asking yesterday is this justice for the Garner family, this firing? What do you think?
5 years ago, the medical examiner found that the cause of Mr. Garner's death was homicide, meaning that he would not have died but for the officer using the illegal chokehold. In the opinion that was released yesterday, the judge said that the former officer lied when he claimed that he hadn't used a chokehold. The evidence was overwhelming that Pantaleo knew exactly what he was doing and that his conduct was reckless. So I think that no one should be satisfied that 5 years later, a homicidal cop who choked a man to death is no longer allowed to be a police officer. That's what's supposed to pass for justice, but it's woefully insufficient. The sad reality is that the only person connected to this case who's gone to jail is Ramsey Orta, the man who took out his cell phone video to show the whole world what the NYPD did to Eric Garner.
You wrote yesterday, and I quote, "When cops are the criminals and people of color are the victims of their abuse, often there is no equal justice under the law." In a case like this, what would equal justice under the law look like?
It would look like accountability. It would look like the NYPD exercising responsibility and the Justice Department exercising responsibility. In this case, even though by yesterday's ruling, a crime had to be proven in order for Officer Pantaleo to be removed from the force. 5 years ago, the Staten Island prosecutor's office declined to bring criminal charges.
And the Justice Department as well declined to bring criminal charges.
Yes, in that case, Attorney General Barr overruled the experienced civil rights lawyers in the criminal division who believed that they could win a case against Officer Pantaleo, that they could prove that he'd broken the law. Nonetheless, the Justice Department declined to bring charges, and that's very frequently the case in which officers are accused of illegally using violence against African-American and Latinx people. In fact, in the 5 years since Mr. Garner's death, there have been 800 other cases in which officers in New York have been charged with using illegal chokeholds. By charge, I mean citizens have complained.
Complaints from citizens. Okay. Let me ask you, in the minute we have left, what do you think this firing means for police accountability in the country as a whole?
So in those 800 cases in New York in which officers have used or been accused of using chokeholds, in fewer than 2% of those cases, have there been any discipline? There have been 40 cases in which the authorities have accepted that, yes, illegal chokeholds have been used. And in those cases, the punishment has been in people being docked vacation pay or people losing vacation days or being docked pay. So, again, that's not sufficient. So what needs to happen is that the police shouldn't be able to arrest people for minor infractions like selling an untaxed cigarette.
Yeah.
That person given a summons, just like when you get a ticket.
Paul Butler, author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Professor Butler, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
So if you're trying to raise money for a good cause, you might consider, say, a bake sale, right? In Pakistan, one way charities fundraise is by collecting animal hides and selling them to tanneries. But as we're about to hear, militants also raise money this way. The story comes from NPR's Dia Hadid in Islamabad, and just a warning, it contains details about animal slaughter.
Over the 3 days of the Muslim holiday of Eid, Pakistanis butchered some 8 million cows, sheep, goats and camels. It's a religious duty and they share the meat with poorer neighbours. Many of those animals are slaughtered in gardens, parks and even on median strips by freelance butchers who roam about with knives. That leaves behind a lot of animal skins and they're worth up to $3 each for Pakistan's leather industry, one of the country's biggest exporters. So for Pakistani charities, there's money to be made in collecting these skins and selling them on. So they hustle. The Eddie Foundation, for example, runs an ambulance network across Pakistan. But during the 3 days of Eid, they transform their emergency control room into a call centre and residents dial the emergency number for an ambulance to collect their animal skin. Muhammad Javed runs this department.
Because of the Eid festival, that we are getting a call from the customers, please collect your animal skins.
Another charity, Al Khidmat, supports seminaries and microfinancing. It pitches large tents across Pakistan. We visited one in Islamabad. 20 bulls were tethered nearby. The group slaughters them for residents. It saves them the headache and the charity gets the hides. They also dispatch volunteers to gather up hides in nearby neighbourhoods. We followed a volunteer down an alley. Bells tied to goats tinkled as they were led away. Shafira Rahman's a math teacher. He called Al Khidmat to pick up the hide of his sacrificial goat. He says it's a good deed. The volunteer stashes the hide into a bag and rides away. But it's not just charities that benefit from this trade. Terrorists and extremist groups also fundraise this way, even though it's illegal. My colleague Abdul Sattar and I went to a mosque. It's associated with the radical Sunni group Sepah-e Sahaba, which is responsible for deadly attacks against Shiites. The group isn't allowed to collect skins, but a mosque seminary teacher, Farooq Ahmed, sat near about a dozen they'd gathered, and he was waiting for more.
The government imposed some restrictions, but they haven't clearly said we can't collect hides. And people don't pay attention to these bans anyway.
Another man, Atar Rahman, drives up to donate 3 skins.
We brought three.
He hasn't heard of a ban either. Pakistan is under intense international pressure to crack down on terrorist financing. An effective action against militant groups collecting hides is one way to show it's serious. Stephen Tankel's a professor at the American University. He's studied Pakistani extremist groups.
This is something that is very, very visible. This is an easy effort for them to make.
A senior Pakistani official spoke to us on condition of anonymity because this is a sensitive issue for the country. He said they are investigating groups that illegally collected hides and they will take action. Tankel, the professor, says this is a litmus test of Pakistan's credibility.
If you're not prepared even to do this, then what else are you not prepared to do?
Back in that alleyway, the maths teacher, Shafira Rahman, says he's not sure what Al Khidmat, that charity that sponsors seminaries, will do with the money they've raised from his goatskin. He's just glad it's been taken away. Because he says he can't stand the sight of blood. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Islamabad.
Let's look ahead to All Things Considered later today. Sea level rise is affecting some coastal areas more than others. And now scientists are trying to figure out why. To listen, ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your local member station by name. This is NPR News.
I'm Liz Taft, artist on The Vineyard. WBUR is on the Cape and Islands at 89.1 and 92.7 FM, and always on the WBUR Listen app.
Ahead on WBUR's Morning Edition, Recycling: how recycling centers around the U.S. are swamped with plastics that can't be recycled. Then in 15 minutes, we hear from Democrat Texas Congressman Al Green, who was one of the first to call for impeachment proceedings against President Trump, on why he's pushing ahead despite opposition by House Democratic leaders. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston Children's Museum, where kids put their creativity to work without screens. Hands-on exhibits, games, and active play in the new Martins Park at the entrance to the Seaport District. Charles River. Join them in Cambridge at the World Congress in September to explore how we can accelerate drug development. SeaRiver.com/World Congress. And Xfinity. Xfinity has a voice remote that lets you search live TV, Netflix, and Prime Video all in one place. More at Xfinity.com.
Now the forecast. WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein says we get a couple more days of unsettled weather before it turns drier.
Humidity levels are lower today as a frontal system passed through the area yesterday with a few thunderstorms. Today's highs will be in the mid to upper 80s, all the sunshine. Tonight, that front comes back. It increases the humidity. Temperatures fall to the 60s. Tomorrow, a couple of showers and storms. A lot of us miss them. Temperatures in the low to mid 80s, partly sunny skies to mostly cloudy. Thursday, partly sunny again, maybe a shower or storm. Temperatures in the mid 80s. Friday, mostly sunny, upper 70s. Saturday and Sunday, we're in the mid to upper 70s, plenty of sunshine.
In Boston now, 72 degrees at 720.
Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang has a plan to save the U.S. economy, a universal basic income, which he says will take the country by storm.
People will realize that we can build a trickle-up economy from ourselves, our families, and our communities up.
The latest in our conversations with 2020 Democratic presidential candidates this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered today from 4 to 6:30 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from ProQuest, creators of ProQuest One Academic, unifying journals, ebooks, videos, and dissertations across disciplines in one mobile-enabled interface. ProQuest.com/go/NPR. Westin Hotels and Resorts, offering a range of wellness options for guests, including their Eat Well menu, on-demand fitness gear lending program, and signature heavenly bed. Learn more at Westin.com, a member of Marriott Bonvoy. And Ballard Spahr, a national law firm providing services in litigation, compliance, and transactions to clients across industries. Assessing the impact of national events and legal developments, keep clients informed. Learn more at BallardSpahr.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm David Green. Good morning. Putting out the recycling, it's a weekly ritual in so many communities around the country, a moment when people can feel like they're doing a good thing for the planet. 40 years ago, one small town helped get recycling started in the United States. NPR's Rebecca Davis paid a visit to see how they're now dealing with the big, complicated industry that recycling has become.
It's Thursday, and Donald Sanderson is wrestling a large blue recycling bin across his front lawn in Woodbury, New Jersey.
Plastic, soda cans, cardboard.
Sanderson is 90, and recycling is close to his heart. After all, he's the one who got recycling started here as a city council member 4 decades ago.
They call me the father of recycling. I don't know if that's good or bad, tell you the truth.
It was the late 1970s, and at the time, curbside recycling was practically non-existent. Trash just went to the landfill. But that was costing the town thousands of dollars in fees, and the landfill was filling up.
Kinsey Landfill was about to close.
Sanderson called around, and he found out that there were markets for some of that trash. Nearby companies would buy it and reuse it. So he said, let's pass a law that requires residents to put their glass, metal, and paper out on the curb in separate buckets. Many thought Sanderson was nuts. Newspaper editorials tore him apart. People worried their taxes would go up.
They dumped trash on my lawn. I would open the door, and they would dump it the night before. And when I came out in the morning, I saw what was there.
Did people dump a lot of trash on your lawn, or what was...
just enough to irritate me, let's put it that way.
So Sanderson got the word out about just how much the landfill was costing the town and how much recycling could save.
Then all of a sudden, I was a great guy.
The city council voted. Sanderson won.
And that's how we got started.
It was 1981, and the small town of Woodbury, New Jersey, became a pioneer in recycling. And, they claim, the first town in the United States to adopt a mandatory curbside recycling program. Word soon spread that recycling was saving Woodbury money, and similar programs cropped up around the country. At first, they were small and local like Woodbury's. Martin Bork is executive director of the Ecology Center, which operates residential recycling in Berkeley, California.
When we started recycling, it was monthly collection of bundled newspaper at the curb, and it went to a local pulper who made egg cartons for the local egg industry.
Then in the 1980s, plastic packaging came along. At first, it was just beverage bottles, but plastic was an irresistible material, partly because it was cheap to produce and transport, and soon everything, it seemed, was made of or came packaged in plastic. The U.S. recycling infrastructure could not keep up. And then China and other Asian countries came along and said, we'll buy your recycling, including all that plastic. This helped take pressure off the industry for a while. On the flip side, it meant the U.S. recycling industry didn't need to keep developing in terms of infrastructure and markets for recycled goods. Meanwhile, towns and cities wanted households to recycle more, so they came up with a way to make it easier. They called it single stream.
Good concept in theory if it worked the way it was supposed to.
Monica Gismondi is recycling coordinator for Gloucester County, where Woodbury is located.
They gave everybody a 96-gallon toter, and they told all the residents, put everything in this one bin, and then we'll take it to the facility, and the facility will sort it out.
But one unintended consequence of single stream, it made people feel like they could throw everything into those bins. And that, Gismondi says, has become a costly pain in the neck for the sorting facilities.
And they were getting the rubber hoses in there and literally the kitchen sink and the bathroom toilets and the bowling balls and the work boots.
And more plastic made from complicated mixes of materials that could not be recycled. You can see the impact at facilities like this one, where household recycling is brought to be sorted, baled, and sold.
You want to see this work of art back here?
I do.
Cool.
Kevin Carducci is part owner and plant manager at Omni Recycling in Pittman, New Jersey. Trucks from Woodbury and other towns stream in and dump their haul.
We'll start right at the tip floor, where the material's dumped.
Standing on the plant floor is like being inside an elaborate marble run, with conveyor belts going up with some materials and down with others.
This is one of our optical sorters, and you can see it's actually separating the number ones and number two plastics.
The machinery segregates the materials Carducci can sell, like those plastic bottles, from what he can't. He points to an enormous pile.
To your right are all the bags that have came off the system in the last 4 hours.
Wow. I mean, I have to say, that's a huge pile of plastic bags.
Isn't that amazing?
And that's just plastic bags.
Just plastic bags. The screens get cleaned 3 times a day to remove all those bags.
Then there's all the other plastics. Pouches, film wrap, chip bags, wrappers, tubs, clamshells, PVC pipes, toys. Carducci says this stuff should never have gone into a recycling bin.
I know I keep stressing this fact, but this is all just the plastics that are non-recyclable that came in this morning.
For years, sorting facilities in the U.S. could ship a lot of this type of plastic to China, which was willing to sort through it. But the non-recyclables ended up making a huge mess on both land and in the ocean. But then China said enough. So now facilities like Omni are stuck.
It cost over $1 million last year to remove all this residue in bags, which is not supposed to even be at the facility.
Carducci will recoup those costs from the taxpayers. Each month, he bills Woodbury and other towns for having processed and disposed of their non-recyclable trash. And that's one reason why local communities are now paying to recycle instead of saving money like they used to. Carducci says everyone would be better off if companies stopped making things out of plastic that can't be recycled.
That's on them. You know what I mean? That is on them. They need to change.
And until they do, Kevin Carducci will continue to cart off the plastics he can't recycle to the landfill. Rebecca Davis, NPR News.
Support for Plastic Tide comes from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family-owned, operated, and argued over since 1980. proud supporter of independent thought, whether that's online, over the air, or in a bottle. More at sierranevada.com.
Just want to give a quick shout out to the team at member station KJZZ here in Tempe, Arizona. They set us up to host the show from here this morning after we interviewed Cindy McCain yesterday. She, of course, lost her husband, the late Senator John McCain, about a year ago. And you'll hear that conversation with Mrs. McCain on the program tomorrow. This is NPR News.
This is WBUR. Ahead on Morning Edition, Twitter and Facebook take action against accounts they say were being used to spread disinformation in Hong Kong, accounts they say were associated with the Chinese government. Coming to WBUR City Space on Friday, September 6th, WBUR sports and society reporter Shira Springer joins Boston Celtics president Danny Ainge to discuss his nearly 40 years in the league as a player, broadcaster, and executive. Get tickets at WBUR.org/cityspace.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Legal Seafoods, announcing new retail products with Stonewall Kitchen, including signature sauces and condiments. Learn more at StonewallKitchen.com/legalseafoods. New England Honda Dealers, proud sponsor of WBUR Traffic Reports during the Honda Summer Spectacular event. HondaDealersOfNewEngland.com. Around here, we Honda. And Spot On, the dog containment and tracking system that helps make the world your backyard. Learn more at spotoncollar.com.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A new survey shows most Americans support so-called red flag laws, which are designed to keep guns out of the hands of people deemed a threat to themselves or others. Lee Patterson with member station KUNC says the survey from APM Research Lab Guns and America was taken before this month's deadly mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio.
77% of Americans support family-initiated extreme risk orders. 70% support these orders when they're initiated by law enforcement. Polling shows the support is strong among Democrats, Republicans, independents, though highest among Democrats. And it's also fairly high among gun owners, too.
The shootings in El Paso and Dayton left 31 people dead. The British Foreign Office says it's looking into reports that an employee of the Hong Kong consulate is being held in mainland China. Here's NPR's Emily Fang.
Hong Kong media reports say 28-year-old Simon Chang lost contact with his girlfriend on August 9th while returning to Hong Kong from a business trip in China's Guangdong province. The UK's embassy in Beijing said in a statement that it is, quote, providing support to their family and seeking further information from authorities in Guangdong province and Hong Kong on Chang's whereabouts. Relations between Beijing and Hong Kong have been tense as Hong Kong pro-democracy protests show no sign of diminishing in their third month. Emily Fang, NPR News, Beijing.
This is NPR News from Washington.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes in Boston. A local developer today begins a push to get state lawmakers to change state law to allow horse racing and a casino in the town of Wareham. The 2011 state gaming law allows for one additional large resort casino in southeastern Mass. The Noto Group details its proposal today for a smaller casino and then meets with Wareham Selectmen tonight. Supporters of a ban in Chelsea on the sale of the tiny liquor bottles known as nips say it's having a positive impact. A ban on 50-milliliter bottles has been in place for a year, and stores have voluntarily stopped selling 100-milliliter nip bottles in Chelsea. Chelsea City Councilor Roy Adeveda says the goal was to combat alcoholism and public drunkenness and says he's noticed changes.
A dramatic decrease in the number of responses required by our ambulance, firefighter, and police on overly intoxicated individuals in our community.
But a package store association says liquor stores in Chelsea have taken a financial hit. New Hampshire is getting more than $5 million in federal funds to study the health effects of toxins. It'll be used to study residents near a Superfund site in northern New Hampshire and toxin levels in homes and wells throughout New Hampshire. The project will look at levels of toxins like mercury, dioxins, and the chemical PFAS. Sports: Red Sox put their five-game winning streak on the line tonight as they host the Philadelphia Phillies. The Sox are now six games out of the wild card slot. Traffic: 290 East in Marlboro. There's a crash on the shoulder before 495. 93 South is 40 minutes now from the Braintree split to Columbia Road, and on the T, there are no major delays right now on any of the subway or commuter rail lines. Forecast should be a beautiful day today, sunny in the mid-80s in Boston and inland, just a few degrees cooler on the Cape and the islands. Tonight it goes to the 60s. Could be stormy tomorrow with showers and a possible downpour and thunderstorm, low 80s tomorrow. Some sun on Thursday, but thunder is still possible. It'll be in the 80s. Then sunny and dry and in the 70s, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. In Boston now, 72 degrees, 68 in Watertown, 66 in Haverhill, and 69 in Braintree at 7:34.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Mercedes-Benz Summer Event. From coupes to sedans to SUVs, local dealers have a range of models now available. More at mbusa.com. The main office of tourism, with wild landscapes and rugged coasts to inspire original lifestyles and authentic adventures. Maine offers travelers an opportunity to discover their very own Maine thing at visitmaine.com. And C3.ai. C3.ai software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King. Good morning. China is using U.S. social media platforms to spread disinformation about pro-democracy protests that have been going on in Hong Kong. That, anyway, is what Twitter and Facebook say. And this week, those two platforms took down nearly 1,000 accounts that they said were being used by Chinese state actors to spread that false information. NPR's Beijing correspondent Emily Feng has been following this. She's on the line now. Hi, Emily.
Good morning.
So what do we know about what has been going on with these accounts and with the misinformation?
Well, Twitter says that it was tipped off to this state-backed activity, and not only did it take down the accounts, it said it was not going to take any more state media advertising money from any outlet. It then went to Facebook and said the same thing is happening on your platform, and Facebook now says it took down 7 pages, 5 accounts, and 3 groups. Remember that both platforms are still under scrutiny in the U.S. for not doing enough to stop the spread of Russian disinformation during the last presidential elections. So this time they preemptively took action to at least shut down some of these Chinese accounts. Beijing today has defended its actions, though, and a foreign ministry spokesperson implied today that the accounts were created by overseas Chinese students and said that those students had the right to express their point of view on any social media outlet.
Okay, just quickly, is there any evidence that we know of that they were created by students overseas?
Some of them certainly described themselves as students and included personal posts, but it's unclear whether they are real accounts made by real people.
We just don't know yet. Okay, so these state-backed accounts, what were they posting exactly?
They're posting the pro-Beijing view on Hong Kong protests. They're sharing content that compares protests to the Islamic State, ISIS. They're sharing images that allegedly show protesters attacking police, harassing travelers at the Hong Kong airport, even false information about protesters being paid off by American agents. Here's a really slick English language video that was made by China's state broadcaster and that's still being shared widely on Twitter bot accounts that are trying to garner sympathy for Hong Kong's police force.
We will allow a certain amount of damage. We will allow a certain amount of disruption to major roads before we deploy. And that is an incredible amount of tolerance for an international city police force.
So everything I've just described, that video, that's the commonly held narrative that's being described within China. But now China is trying to make that narrative global, and it's doing so through Twitter and Facebook. Keep in mind that these two platforms are blocked in China, so anyone who can see them ostensibly would be outside of China. And data released by Twitter this week shows that the accounts in question were posting in as many as 10 languages, including Spanish and English. Some of the accounts are really new. They appear to have been created just as the protests were taking off, but some of them are more than a decade old, including one that had 180,000 followers and posted both anti-Hong Kong and pro-President Trump tweets.
So why is China doing this exactly? What's the endgame?
Well, it invests a lot in managing perceptions at home, not just with the Hong Kong protests, but with any kind of politically sensitive event. But as China's become more influential on the global stage, it's realized that it's had to manage perceptions outside of China. And they've globalized very traditional propaganda channels like newspapers, television. But now the internet's given them this really powerful tool to amplify those efforts, like on Twitter and Facebook that we've seen this week.
Yeah. NPR's Emily Feng. Emily, thanks so much.
Thank you.
New Mexico's Ben Ray Lujan yesterday became the highest-ranking House Democrat to announce support for impeaching President Trump. The assistant House Speaker joined a growing majority of House Democrats who favor that action. One of the first of them was Texas lawmaker Al Green, who originally filed articles of impeachment in the House in 2017. While some Democratic lawmakers believe winning the next election is the best way to remove the president from office, Green does not want to wait.
The way to deal with this is not just to defeat an unfit president, but to impeach as well.
NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales caught up with the congressman in his district in Houston.
Al Green's impeachment case against Donald Trump started in a law school class at Texas Southern University in the early 1970s. It was there that Green learned the legal ins and outs of bringing charges against a sitting president.
And my guess is if I hadn't gone to law school, I wouldn't have had that sense of how to remove a president from office.
The Houston area Democrat quietly filed his first articles of impeachment the day before Trump was sworn in as president. Green boycotted his inauguration. About 4 months later, Trump fired FBI Director James Comey. Green viewed that move as the president obstructing an investigation into Russian interference during the 2016 campaign. And within days, Green took his case of impeaching the president to the House floor.
I am a voice in the wilderness, but I assure you that history will vindicate me.
More than 2 years later, there's more voices in that wilderness. Green has now brought his articles of impeachment to the House floor 3 times. But now he has more help making the case. A majority of House Democrats are publicly calling for impeachment. This week, the number 4 Democrat, Representative Ben Ray Lujan of New Mexico, became the latest. Again, Green.
Things start with a spark, and sometimes the spark is ignored. Other times the spark can cause others to become consumed with the righteousness of a cause and participate in the cause itself.
But Speaker Nancy Pelosi is not on board with Green yet, saying they still need to finish their investigations.
With all the respect in the world for him, we have 6 committees that are working on following the facts.
Green isn't focusing his message on Pelosi right now, but he's frustrated with Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler. Nadler is the one who would lead any impeachment inquiry into the president, and Green thinks he's sending mixed messages on where he stands.
If you're for it, you say it. And if you're not, then you own it. And then history will judge us all.
Most members supporting impeachment represent safe Democratic districts. But Green is convinced that more House Democrats will sign on. The 8-term congressman has been on a bit of an impeachment tour this summer from Michigan to Mississippi. He's saying the way to galvanize support is to start with one person and take your message around the country.
Everything can start with a single person. It's called the power of one. Sometimes things start with one person, and then they multiply.
Green expects to bring up his articles of impeachment on the House floor a 4th time after Congress returns from recess next month. Support for impeachment has grown, but Green still needs it from the one who matters most, Speaker Pelosi. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, Houston.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Ahead on Morning Edition, a new report looking at the concentration in some communities of Massachusetts residents still without health insurance. Forecast, a great summer day today. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
A beautiful Tuesday across the area. Still warm, 83 to 88, but humidity levels have dropped. That humidity is coming back tonight under partly cloudy skies down to the 60s. perhaps an early shower, then a better chance for a few showers for an hour or two during the middle part of tomorrow. Temperatures will get to the low to mid-80s. On Thursday, an early shower or storm, otherwise partly sunny, mid-80s. The humidity really drops Friday through the weekend. Temperatures 75 to 80, mostly sunny skies.
In Boston now, 72 degrees.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Cityside Subaru on Route 60 in Belmont. The summer all-wheel drive-away event is underway, featuring the all-wheel drive Subaru Ascent with seating for eight. CitysideSubaru.com. Indeed, with its skills tests built for employers who want to see a deeper sense of the person behind the resume. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire. And the Alzheimer's Association, working toward a vision of a world without Alzheimer's, providing care and support to all those facing the disease with a commitment to advancing critical research. More at ALZ.org.
Now, Bostonomics Business shares in Cambridge-based Sarepta Therapeutics are down more than 10% in pre-market trading this morning on news that federal regulators failed to approve its newest treatment for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. The company says the Food and Drug Administration rejected the drug due to the risk of infection and kidney damage. It's seeking to meet with the FDA to determine the next steps. The Leicester-based firm Cultivate is building a new marijuana cultivation facility in Uxbridge. The company paid $2 million for the property in a business park near Route 16 and 146. Cultivate currently operates a cultivation center and dispensary in Leicester. This is WBUR at 745.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Plymouth Rock Assurance, offering customers a ride home through their Get Home Safe program. Learn more at PlymouthRock.com. And the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping public radio advance journalistic excellence in the digital age, informed communities essential for healthy democracy. KnightFoundation.org.
This is WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes. It's the highest rate of citizens with health insurance in the U.S. In Massachusetts, fewer than 3% of residents are without health insurance. But a new report finds one quarter of communities across the state have much higher rates than that, ranging from the 3% all the way to 25%. These hotspots are the subject of that report out this morning from the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts Foundation. We spoke about the report with Foundation President Audrey Shelto, along with Lily Silva with the East Boston Community Health Center. So, Audrey, let me start with you. Looking at the maps in the report that represent uninsured hotspots in every region of the state, pockets of, for example, Boston, Revere, Everett, Arred, but also a chunk of Nantucket, parts of Martha's Vineyard, and Somerville. So let me ask you to give us a snapshot profile of who we're talking about.
In almost all areas of the state, there are pockets of people who are not insured and therefore communities that have higher uninsured rates. Those communities tend to be lower income communities. They tend to have a higher percentage of young adults, people between the ages of 18 and 34, a higher percentage of men, also a higher percentage of people who are non-citizens.
And what are the common economic and social factors these folks are facing?
In those areas where there's highest rates and highest densities of uninsurance, nearly one quarter of the families have incomes below the federal poverty level, and over one half pay more than 30% of their incomes towards housing costs.
Don't people in these communities qualify for MassHealth, the state's Medicaid program for insurance subsidies?
Some do, and some are eligible but not enrolled, and that's a lot of the work that community health centers and others do to try to get people who are eligible into coverage. But some don't because of their citizen status, or some don't because they may work part-time and, you know, not be clear about whether they can get coverage through their employer or not. But some would be eligible for MassHealth, and those are the ones we really want to focus on getting coverage.
But in terms of the non-citizens, if you're here illegally, you're not eligible for it. And that's what drives that number up.
If you're a non-citizen, your eligibility for insurance coverage in Massachusetts depends on whether you're a term called lawfully present. And that applies to their eligibility for comprehensive MassHealth or limited MassHealth coverage. It's a complicated set of rules around whether you're eligible for coverage based on things like income, age, health status.
Lily, how do you see this playing out in your work?
We spend a lot of our efforts around education and outreach. We have a team of certified application counselors that are ready to help patients apply for insurance, and they will work with them and help them navigate the process, which can be quite complex and overwhelming to folks.
Let me ask about non-citizens, if I might. In the current national climate, how do you overcome what might very well be a perception or a reality that applying for a government health insurance program is a risky move?
These are extremely challenging times related to that issue. While a small number of people probably in the Commonwealth would technically, according to the public charge rule, be at risk of their immigration status, the ambiguity and the broadness of the language in the public charge rule puts the fear into a much, much broader population. People who have mass health coverage now may drop it because they're concerned that having that mass health coverage could jeopardize their immigration status.
We'll put a target on their backs.
Exactly.
Lily, do you hear these concerns?
We do quite a bit, and we do have patients for the last couple of weeks calling and asking questions about reassurance about the process. And also had a couple of people call and just cancel their appointments, opting to put off maybe renewing their application. So we are starting to see that that concern and that fear and confusion is out there.
So in the bigger picture, what is it that you would hope that government officials, state lawmakers, do with the data from this report? Lily?
I think on our end, the more we can simplify these processes, the better. As much as we have a system that encourages people to apply, the process is still quite complex and overwhelming. So the more that we could make it simple and straightforward, I think would be beneficial.
Audrey.
I hope state policymakers will find this report to be useful in focusing their efforts in trying to locate those populations who don't have higher rates of coverage and try to figure out the best way to get them enrolled, whether it's multilingual marketing materials, navigators to help them figure out how to work through the system and get enrolled.
Audrey Shelto, president of the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts Foundation, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Same to you, Lily Silva from the East Boston Community Health Center.
Thank you so much.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's the height of corn season. So let's lend an ear to resident chef Kathy Gunst, who says, don't throw away the cobs. She has some delicious dishes made with corn, and she'll share them with us. That's today at noon on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Ahead on WBUR's Morning Edition, NPR's Susan Stamberg on a new art exhibit in Washington addressing the history of migration and the current migrant crisis. Forecast, widespread sunshine today. It'll be in the 80s in Boston, inland and on the shore. Tomorrow, we get clouds, maybe a thunderstorm and heavy rain in the 80s tomorrow. Partly sunny Thursday, but a thunderstorm remains possible. It'll be in the 80s again. Then Friday, Saturday, and Sunday all look perfect. Sunny, low humidity, 70s all 3 days. 72 degrees in Boston now at 752.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Mass General Cancer Center at Emerson Hospital in Concord. Cancer specialists and leading technology for the latest treatment options. EmersonHospital.org/cancer. Salem 5 Bank, introducing the Open Account. One checking choice open to everyone. Visit Salem5.com/open to learn more. And Sunbug Solar, a certified B Corporation, offering full-service solar system design and installation. Learn what the sun can do for you at sunbugsolar.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King. Good morning. A short drive from the White House, where immigration policy is a major focus of the president's agenda, a museum has filled three floors with artists' reactions to displacement, to relocation, and to flight. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg says the exhibition is pretty intense.
Every day brings the stories on radio, TV, social media. What can art say that's different?
Art has a language of its own. It's very direct.
Dorothy Kaczynski is director of the Phillips Collection, where the exhibition, The Warmth of Other Suns, Stories of Global Displacement, is on view.
Do the artists look at suffering in a different way?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
Danny Levinas, chairman of the museum's board.
But they know how to express it.
In paintings, photographs, videos, installations chosen by curators from the new museum in New York. Many of the artists are immigrants themselves and come from all over: Algeria, Bangladesh, Belgium, Brazil, Mexico, Syria. Albanian artist Adrian Paci explores hope, impatience, frustration.
What you see in this video is a stairway, the kind that you would use to board an airplane on an empty tarmac.
New museum curator Natalie Bell.
What's absent in this film is the airplane. So you see a number of men attempting to board, climbing up the stairs and waiting.
For what? They're on a stairway to nowhere. The plane may never come. French-Algerian artist Kader Atiya has strewn a gallery's wooden floor with faded blue clothing, T-shirts, jeans, sweatshirts, shoes. The installation is called The Dead Sea.
It once evokes an image of clothing that's been washed up on the shore, but also serves as a kind of memorial of the people who've been lost at sea.
Sometimes I turn the page on such sights. Maybe you do too. Gotten numb from so much tragedy. Some 71 million souls forcibly displaced from their homes, the UN says. Too much. You just can't think about it. But this exhibition, in its persistent, gentle enormity, forces attention.
So many of these various objects in the exhibition are very specific. They're things we know. And yet they have such a powerful emotional impact on us. What's that about?
Well, I think that there can be a way that objects can evoke memories or reflections, even if they're very everyday objects.
Another, not just that, but feelings.
Yeah. You know, we spend a lot of our time encountering these stories through the news. And when we slow down and spend a moment with these objects individually, when we encounter them physically, it can be very different and it can be very powerful.
Children appear in several of these images. In a video, they stand on opposite sides of the Strait of Gibraltar.
They're between Spain and Morocco, and you see children walking from the shore from each of those countries.
Holding toy sailboats they have made with old flip-flops, they start moving toward one another. Frances Alice, Belgian-born, Mexico-based, imagined them serving as a bridge across the waters. Instead, buffeted by waves, tossed, thrown, they disappear. The most stirring of these 75 or so objects in this immigration show is Erkan Özcan's video of a 13-year-old Syrian boy describing the bombing of his town, seeing neighbors being killed, going without food, water, the horror of it.
He's not speaking a word. He's deaf and mute, so he's using hand language to tell this story, and somehow taking the words out of this story made it all the more powerful.
It's a short video, yet the impact is immense.
I think it is one of the most powerful pieces because it's hard to watch and it's hard to not watch. It's hard to turn away.
I do, before it's over. And realize that's what we do now. Turn from the terrible realities of this global displacement we're living through. So far from our shores in so many places, so smack on our borders this very minute. Art like this can turn us back. In Washington, I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
This is WBUR. Forecast, sunny mid-80s today in Boston and inland, low 80s on the shore and on the Cape and the Islands. Tonight it drops to the 60s. Tomorrow could be stormy with showers and maybe thunderstorms and downpours, low 80. Sun returns for Thursday, some sun anyway, but a thunderstorm is still possible. It'll be in the 80s Thursday. Then sunny and in the 70s, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and low humidity all 3 days. In Boston now, 73 degrees. It's 1 minute before 8.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston Children's Hospital, named the number one children's hospital in the nation by U.S. News & World Report for the 6th year in a row. Boston Children's, where the world comes for answers. Loomis Sayles, celebrating 90 years of serving the investment needs of institutional and mutual fund clients worldwide. Learn more at loomissales.com. And Starry Internet. Starry has up to 200 megabits per second speeds and 24/7 support. Starry.com. Happy interneting.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston,
92.7 WBUA Tisbury,
89.1 WBUH Brewster,
streaming at WBUR.org,
and live at City Space, Boston's new home for public conversation.
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
A New York City police officer is fired for his role in the chokehold death of Eric Garner in 2014, the death that sparked national debate on police use of force. It's Tuesday, August 20th. This is Morning Edition. Good morning, I'm Bob Oates. Coming up, the New York Police Department moved to fire the officer. Also, what's ahead for Planned Parenthood after it drops out of the federal Title X program over new White House rules to limit how clinicians can talk to patients about abortion?
The Trump administration is doing this as an attack on reproductive health care and to keep providers from serving our patients.
And this hour, students on the move at Roxbury Community College to shut down the nursing program.
There's not many programs for working people like myself that want to get their lives on a better track.
Red Sox play the Phillies at Fenway tonight, and the forecast, sunny in the 80s today. It's 8:01. Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. China has pushed back on a decision by Twitter and Facebook to remove nearly 1,000 accounts and operations because they were part of a Chinese state-backed disinformation operation. NPR's Emily Fang reports the accounts spreading false information about Hong Kong pro-democracy protests.
China's foreign ministry defended the accounts, saying it was China's right to share its views on Facebook and Twitter. It also implied that the accounts were registered by overseas Chinese students, a claim that could not be independently verified. All of the deleted accounts were critical of Hong Kong protesters, likening them to terrorists and rioters. Facebook and Twitter have come under fire for not doing enough to stop Russian disinformation campaigns during the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Twitter now says it will stop advertising content from state-funded media outlets. Emily Fang, NPR News, Beijing.
Facebook is a financial supporter of NPR. Vice President Mike Pence is headed to suburban Virginia today. NPR's Giles Snyder reports he is to chair a meeting of the National Space Council.
The vice president is leading the Space Council's meeting at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum's Udvar-Hazy Center in Chantilly, Virginia. The council is expected to hear from NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine. A group of Texas Republican lawmakers want Bridenstine to reconsider his decision to base the development of the next lunar lander at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama. They argue that the Johnson Space Flight Center in Houston is a better fit given its history.
NPR's Giles Snyder. French President Emmanuel Macron has met Russian President Vladimir Putin ahead of this weekend's G7 summit in France. That's a meeting Putin won't be attending since Russia was kicked out of the G8 for invading Crimea in 2014. Jake Saganero reports from Paris the leaders traded jabs over freedom of speech.
Macron invited Putin to Fort Bregançon, the imposing presidential summer residence in southern France. When asked about the crackdown on protesters marching for free elections in Russia, Putin said authorities are acting within the law and that he wants to avoid a situation similar to the yellow vest demonstrations in France, where police and protesters have been injured. Macron was clearly offended.
La France a toujours respecté non seulement sa constitution, ses droits.
France has always respected our constitution and human rights, says Macron. Yellow vest protesters are also free to run for office in local and European elections. The French president says he will continue efforts to bring Russia back into the group of world leaders. For NPR News, I'm Jake Saganaro in Paris.
An Iranian-flagged oil tanker released by authorities in Gibraltar continues to sail toward Greece. The Wall Street Journal reports the U.S. State Department is warning Greece against hosting the tanker. It was originally impounded in Gibraltar after British authorities there alleged it was illegally taking oil to Syria. You're listening to NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes in Boston. As it nears its first anniversary, the head of the MGM Springfield Casino says the facility is headed in the right direction. But that's despite falling well short of expectations for gambling revenue to this point. Here's reporter Adam Frenier.
MGM estimated it would take in $412 million in year one, but through more than 11 months it had collected just $252 million. President and COO Mike Mathis says one factor has been more competition than expected from Connecticut's two tribal casinos.
This market has some really strong competitors that have been in the market for 20-plus years. So I think we may have underestimated, that level of loyalty and what it would take for those customers to give us a shot.
Mathis also blames changing market conditions after the projections were made several years before opening. He says besides gambling revenue, the casino's hotel and restaurants have been performing well. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Adam Frenier.
They're on the road. More than 100 people are marching from Boston to New Hampshire as a way to call attention to federal immigration policy. The six-day march began yesterday near Boston City Hall Plaza and will make its way through Lynn, Danvers, and Newburyport before ending at the County Department of Corrections in Dover, New Hampshire. The march is made up of immigrant rights advocates and religious groups. Federal fishing regulators are slated to be in Gloucester tonight and in Bourne tomorrow to discuss ways to save the endangered North Atlantic right whale. It's estimated there are just over 400 of the whales left in the entire world. The concern is the whales can get tangled in fishing gear and become seriously injured or killed from the equipment. The meetings are aimed at finding ways to reduce those entanglements. Many students in Haverhill Public Schools will have free breakfast delivered directly to their classrooms when the new school year begins next week. The school superintendent tells the Eagle Tribune carts with cereal, fruit, bagels, and other foods will be brought to classrooms at city elementary and middle schools to make it easier for students to take advantage of free breakfast. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by AL Prime Energy Consultant, distributor of wholesale gasoline and diesel fuels for retail and commercial use. ALPrime.com. Tufts University, University College, where high schoolers sample the college experience and earn Tufts credit. Fall courses at universitycollege.tufts.edu. And the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org.
Sports: Red Sox and the Philadelphia Phillies begin a two-game series tonight at Fenway. The Red Sox announced yesterday that starting pitcher Chris Sale will not need surgery on his inflamed pitching elbow, but his season is most likely over. Traffic: 128 North in Lexington. There's a crash after Route 2. 95 North is slow from Route 123 in North Attleboro to a crash after Route 152. And the westbound Ted Williams Tunnel is 17 minutes now from East Boston to the Seaport. Forecast: beautiful day ahead, sunny mid-80s in Boston and inland, and just a few degrees cooler on the Cape and the islands. Tonight it drops to the 60s. Could be stormy tomorrow with showers and possible downpours and thunderstorms, low 80s. Some sun on Thursday with thunder still possible in the 80s, then sunny in the 70s Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. In Boston now, 73 degrees at 8:08.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm David Green. We are still tracking the consequences of financier and convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein's death in custody. Yesterday, it was revealed Epstein signed a will days before his apparent suicide, and that could complicate lawsuits targeting his estate. Also yesterday, Attorney General William Barr ousted Hugh Hurwitz from his post as the acting director of the Bureau of Prisons. He'll be replaced by Kathleen Hawke Sawyer, who previously served in that role from 1992 to 2003. Joining me now is Catherine Lineweaver. She's the former warden of the Metropolitan Correctional Center in Manhattan, where Epstein 2015 died. She also worked with Kathleen Hawke Sawyer, and she's with us from Wichita, Kansas. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, David. It's good to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you. Can you talk to us about Kathleen Hawke Sawyer? I know you worked for her. You've known her. What does she bring to the table in this job?
Dr. Sawyer is a solid leader. She's known for her integrity, her no-nonsense way of leadership, was always seen as a visionary. She was the director of the Bureau of Prisons during our largest growth period to date, brought on thousands of new staff, many, many new facilities. She is just solid as they come.
Well, let's talk about the job she's coming into. I mean, I think many of us are learning so much about the Bureau of Prisons through this moment, Epstein's apparent suicide. I mean, it seems to have highlighted some systemic problems. You said the agency is facing a perfect storm of challenges right now. What do you mean by that?
Well, the federal government has a mandatory retirement age of 57. And in the year of 1990, it was our largest hiring year to date. 4,500 employees were hired. And subsequently throughout the 90s, as the Bureau grew, many, many more were hired. Well, if you think about the age of those employees, they are all retiring in mass numbers. And we have been unable to hire behind them, either because of hiring freezes or lack of recruitment, or just the sheer reason that millennials are not intrigued to go to work in corrections. So that's all what leads to this perfect storm that I've described.
Well, what you're describing seems to be playing out at the Metropolitan Correctional Center. I mean, this prison that we've all been focusing on, where you served as warden, the president of the Union for Federal Corrections Officers said that prison is currently functioning with fewer than 70% of the needed officers. How concerning is that?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that in no agency in the government are you ever at 100% staffed. You're usually funded at about 80%. And with your ins and outs, with transfers and hires and retires, you're usually doing pretty well if you're staffed at 80%. 70% is a little low. I will have to agree with Mr. Young on that point.
So let's talk about the prison. I mean, there have been reports that the guards watching Epstein were working extreme overtime, which I suppose could be a result of understaffing. Guards failed to check on him for 3 hours. I mean, reports of staff members falling asleep. How could something like this happen? Did that shock you as it did for many of us?
Well, first of all, I hesitate to comment too much on it because I haven't seen the written after action report that definitively proves that's the truth and not speculation. To speak in general, thought process, could someone who is working the 16-hour shift, which means they've been mandated to stay an extra hour, could they fall asleep? Yes, they could. To have multiple people falling asleep, that's a stretch.
So we have this moment with a change of leadership in the Bureau of Prisons. We've had all these concerns raised by Epstein's death. Make the link for me. How much control, how much influence can the Bureau have on the issues that led to this happening?
You can't hold one person responsible. It is systemic. You started the article out with the acting director, Hurwitz, being ousted. He was just an acting, and he was doing the best job he can. One person cannot be responsible for all of this. Although I think Kathy Hawke Sawyer is a great leader, it's going to be very difficult for one person to fix it. It's going to take hiring staff to get this done.
Catherine Leineweaver is a former warden of the Metropolitan Correctional Center in New York City. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
All right, in Moscow, that city has been seeing some of its biggest anti-government protests in years. Protesters are upset that authorities there won't let opposition candidates run in upcoming city council elections. And during these demonstrations, a new protest leader has emerged. NPR's Lucian Kim met her in Moscow.
After more and more people started taking to the streets of Moscow last month, the authorities gave opposition leaders short-term jail sentences to get them out of the way. That's put the spotlight on Lubov Sobol, a 31-year-old lawyer who was among the opposition candidates barred from running in the Moscow City Council elections. So far, she has avoided jail time and taken up the mantle of protest leader.
The government is very afraid the myth they spread via state propaganda will be destroyed, namely, that only 2% of the population supports the democratic opposition, and that we have no constructive political platform, and just like protesting on the street.
Sobol meets me in the offices of Alexei Navalny, Russia's most prominent opposition politician, who was blocked from running against Vladimir Putin in last year's presidential election. Navalny, who's currently in jail, has been an inspiration for a new crop of political activists, including Sobol, who has worked with him for more than 8 years. She took her case directly to a meeting with the head of Russia's Central Election Commission earlier this month. Ella Pamfilova, the chair of the Election Commission, was unyielding. She said Sobol presented herself as a European-style Democrat, while at the same time blackmailing the Election Commission with threats of street protests. The commission was final in its ruling that Sobol and her fellow candidates had not collected enough valid signatures to qualify for the ballot. Sobol says the authorities have rigged the system to block any independent candidates from running and went on a one-month hunger strike to protest the decision. Back in Navalny's office, Sobol is visibly weak because she still can't eat solid food yet. But she says she gets strength from the hope her now 5-year-old daughter will one day live in a democratic Russia.
I want her to live in a country where human rights and freedoms are respected, where the courts are independent, and where there is a free press. I want her to live in this country. I don't want to move away.
Sobol is well aware of the risks of staying. Her husband was assaulted outside their home 2 years ago, and even though she's avoided jail time for now, the authorities could press criminal charges against her at any moment. I ask her whether she welcomes expressions of support from the West, since Russian state media portray the Moscow protesters as stooges of the State Department.
The West has its own interests, and I don't have any hope for help from the West. I think only the people of this country can bring about some kind of change.
At the same time, she adds, the Kremlin is very sensitive about international opinion, and that may be what's keeping her out of prison. People have a lot of pent-up anger and desire for change, she says. And even after the September City Council elections, she'll continue fighting for political change. Lucian Kim, NPR News, Moscow.
More than 1,000 Google employees have demanded that the company publicly commit not to work with U.S. immigration enforcement agencies, and that includes the Border Patrol and ICE. This petition is forcing Google's hand at a time when it's risky for big tech to criticize the Trump administration. Here's NPR's Aarti Shahani.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection announced it's looking for a cloud provider, a tech company at the cutting edge of big data storage, to give IT support to its mission of securing the nation's border. Mark Egerman, a product manager at Google and an author of the petition, says while his company has not yet applied for the job, it's not too early to protest.
There's the old parable that the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is today.
Googlers asked their bosses to commit to not applying, but Egerman says the bosses wouldn't. And given the enormous scale of the job, Border Patrol collects extensive data, including biometrics, on millions of people coming in and out, he says it's very likely Google would apply.
There are about 3 companies in the United States capable of providing the cloud computing resources that CBP is asking for. Google is one of them.
Amazon and Microsoft are the others he's referring to. Those two companies are competing for a lucrative Pentagon contract. Google, which makes money from ads, wants to take a lead in the cloud business, It's a huge financial opportunity as governments and companies move data online. But many rank-and-file Googlers are critical of Trump's immigration track record, the imprisonment of asylum seekers, separating migrant children from their parents, the alleged death of children in custody, and sexual abuse.
Let them out! Let them out!
Google founder Sergey Brin turned his company into a prominent voice against the administration when he showed up to San Francisco International Airport in 2017 to protest the president's ban against travelers from certain Muslim countries. Google did not respond to NPR's request for comment to this new employee petition. Eagerman says he knows it's putting a spotlight on the company that leaders don't want, especially given the right-wing charge that Silicon Valley giants have an anti-conservative bias.
I am not envious of them for having to figure out how to best navigate this situation.
In an interview with Fox News, acting CBP Commissioner Mark Morgan called the Google petition absolutely irresponsible. Arthi Shahani, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Coming up, evacuations due to wildfires in Alaska during what's normally a wet season. Then in 15 minutes, our police departments in California ready to implement the new state law on use of force, the strictest such law in the country. The time is 8:19.
We are funded by you, our listeners, and by Ann Barrick, who will use offshore wind to replace coal power at Brayton Point, bringing clean energy into your home. Learn more about Ann Barrick at annbarrick.com. And AVFX, Advanced Audio, Video, and Lighting Services for meeting planners, event producers, and trade show managers. AVFX.com. Our passion shows. And the MindBody app, used by millions to find and book fitness classes at local studios. Fitness studios can list their business at mindbodyonline.com/Boston.
Now the forecast. WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein says after sun today, we get a couple of days of unsettled weather before it turns drier.
Humidity levels are lower today as a frontal system passed through the area yesterday with a few thunderstorms. Today's highs will be in the mid to upper 80s, all the sunshine. Tonight, that front comes back. It increases the humidity. Temperatures fall to the 60s. Tomorrow, a couple of showers and storms. A lot of us miss them. Temperatures in the low to mid 80s, partly sunny skies to mostly cloudy. Thursday, partly sunny again, maybe a shower or storm. Temperatures in the mid 80s. Friday, mostly sunny, upper 70s. Saturday and Sunday, we're in the mid to upper 70s, plenty of sunshine.
In Boston now, 74 degrees. It's now 8:21.
Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang has a plan to save the U.S. economy, a universal basic income, which he says will take the country by storm.
People will realize that we can build a trickle-up economy from ourselves, our families, and our communities up.
The latest in our conversations with 2020 Democratic presidential candidates this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered, today from 4 to 6:30 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from LegalZoom, recognizing National Make-A-Will Month during August. For more than 18 years, LegalZoom has been helping Americans protect their family and assets. More information is available at LegalZoom.com/NPR. Wells Fargo, investing $1 billion in housing affordability programs through 2025, working with nonprofits, housing experts, and community leaders to drive new solutions. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/impact. And Jane and Gerald Katcher, supporting the Children's Movement of Florida, dedicated to helping all children enter school with the social, emotional, and intellectual skills needed to succeed. More information is available at childrensmovementflorida.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King. Good morning. Mexico's new president is a populist. He's a leftist. And there's this thing he says a lot. You can't have a rich government where the people are poor. So in the first few months of his administration, he has slashed government spending, cut thousands of federal jobs, and ended some of the perks of being a Mexican politician. Many people love it, but some others think his thriftiness has gone too far. NPR's Carrie Kahn has the story.
President Andrés Manuel López Obrador says it's time lawmakers live like regular Mexicans. He's done away with chauffeur-driven cars, expense accounts, and high salaries, starting with his own. He cut the presidential pay by 60%. He's trying to sell the presidential plane and now flies commercial. And in a stroke of populist genius, he turned the opulent presidential residence into a public park and museum.
¿Cómo están? Buenos días. Bienvenidos a todos.
On a recent Sunday, federal employees hold an auction right on the grounds, selling thousands of pieces of jewelry seized from drug traffickers, tax cheats, and white-collar criminals.
Y lo importante es el destino de los recursos.
Ricardo Rodriguez Vargas says all proceeds will go to the poorest communities in the country. Rodriguez heads up the federal agency, which was just renamed the Institute to Return the Stolen to the People. He's held four auctions of seized goods so far this year.
Tengo 200 y pido 205. 205 los tengo. 210. Está hermosísimo.
Among the 2,000 items being auctioned are solid gold pistol grips, diamond bracelets, and all sorts of designer watches, like this one, hitting the $11,000 asking price.
A la una. 205,000. A las dos. Vendido.
Observer Jose Luis Aguilar is stunned by all the opulence on display.
Está bastante bien la medida que está tomando su presidente.
He's doing the right thing, our president, by showing us all that's been stolen, the impunity in our country. This is great, says Aguilar. But critics say López Obrador's austerity and cost-cutting has gone too far. He's put public hospitals at risk by reducing personnel and supplies, let forest fires rage while laying off firefighters, and slashed 2D federally funded science and art projects.
Cuts have been done with a machete instead of doing them with a scalpel.
Denise Dresser, a professor and political commentator, says what is most worrisome is that López Obrador is getting rid of competent civil servants and replacing them with what she says are yes men and women.
Those who believe in his form of transformation. So he's replacing one form of dysfunctional government with another form of dysfunctional government.
Last month, López Obrador's finance minister, a longtime political ally, abruptly resigned, citing what he called ideological extremism in economic decision-making. Jose Angel Santamarina knows about the cost-cutting all too well. He was a top executive at ProMexico, a division in the economy ministry that promoted Mexican businesses and investment at home and abroad. Last spring, he and the entire division were let go, some 500 workers.
They are closing, but without offering a new or a different alternative. And we are worried about that. There's no plan B.
He says Mexico's economy can't survive without foreign investors and the expertise of offices like his. In fact, economists warn Mexico is heading for a recession. Growth has been below 1% so far this year. A lot of that has to do with global economic pressures. But critics say López Obrador's handling of the economy isn't helping. He's redirecting a lot of his austerity savings to billion-dollar infrastructure projects that market watchers say are too expensive and environmentally unsound. Historian Lorenzo Mayer, who supports the president, says change is hard after decades of privilege enjoyed by so many corrupt politicians and elites.
I am pretty sure that a lot of upper-class Mexicans, and even middle-class, don't feel that Andrés Manuel López Obrador is the kind of president that Mexico needs.
But he says the general population backs him, with some polls giving the president a 70% approval rating. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Mexico City.
It's been an unusual summer in Alaska, really warm, really dry, and that long stretch of hot weather has set the stage for wildfires, including one sparked over the weekend that has burned dozens of buildings. Fires have damaged major highways, also forced evacuations. Nat Herz with Alaska Public Media has more.
Outside an overnight shelter in the town of Wasilla, Renee Shinton is getting her huskies ready for bed. The McKinley wildfire is burning in a rural area about 50 miles north of Anchorage, and she's one of many dog mushers who have been forced to evacuate.
Not knowing where I'm going to live, not knowing where I'm going to go, if I'm going to have a house or anywhere to go. I can't go to a hotel. I can't
I have 11 dogs.
The McKinley fire started Saturday when strong winds blew a tree into power lines near the highway connecting Anchorage to Fairbanks. It grew quickly on Sunday, burning more than 50 buildings and shutting down the highway. The winds also worsened another wildfire that had been under control. That one has been burning for more than 2 months on the Kenai Peninsula, south of Anchorage. Alaska Governor Mike Dunleavy is warning residents that they need to be cautious.
With camping season and hunting season coming soon upon us, we're asking everyone to be very, very careful with regard to campfires and cooking outdoors.
Fire authorities in the lower 48 have dispatched 10 firefighting crews and a half dozen aircraft to the state to help Alaska's emergency responders. South Central Alaska, where the fires are burning, has set numerous records this summer for heat and lack of rainfall. August is known as the wettest time of year in Anchorage, but this year it's on track to be the driest late summer month ever recorded, says Fairbanks-based climatologist Rick Toman.
Basically, every superlative you can think of applies in South Central this summer.
Toman says the high winds over the weekend were the trigger for the fires, but they couldn't have happened without the preceding months-long stretch of dry weather, combined with an early snowmelt.
The first pieces were falling into place, you know, back in April when the snow went early. The weather set the stage for a trigger like this unusual wind event.
The National Climate Assessment says Alaska is warming twice as fast as the global average, and that's expected to drive an increase in wildfires like the ones burning now. For NPR News, I'm Nat Herz in Anchorage.
This is NPR News.
On 90.9 WBUR, coming up, Planned Parenthood's decision to drop out of the federal Title X program after the Trump administration changes to Title X rules to make it harder for patients to get information on abortion. It's 8:29.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Knox Financial, offering homeowners planning to move the option of not selling their home and keeping it as a financial asset. With Knox, you can convert your home to an income property. Knox handles the details. Learn how your home could perform as an investment property at knoxincome.com. And Huntington Theater Company with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, a comedy by Academy Award winner Tom Stoppard, starts September 20th. HuntingtonTheater.org.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Romania's president will be at the White House today for talks with President Trump. NPR's Giles Snyder says this will be their second meeting since Trump took office.
The White House says a visit by Romanian President Klaus Iohannis is part of a series of meetings with leaders from Central Europe. A senior administration official told reporters on a conference call that President Trump wants to show the importance of the region to the U.S., not only as allies, but as future business partners. President Iohannis is visiting as Romania prepares to mark 30 years since throwing off the communist rule of Nicolae Ceausescu and 15 years since Bucharest joined NATO. This is Iohannis' second White House meeting with President Trump. He last visited over the summer of 2017. Giles Snyder, NPR News, Washington.
China's foreign ministry is objecting after Twitter and Facebook suspended hundreds of accounts and operations believed to be part of a coordinated effort by Beijing to undermine pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong. Ben Nimmo is the director of digital investigations at Graphica.
Both platforms saying variations on the theme that they have found people who are linked to the Chinese government who've got caught running troll campaigns against the Hong Kong protesters.
China argues it has a right to express its views on social media. Twitter and Facebook are sponsors of NPR. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes in Boston. A Quincy developer wants to build a small horse racing track and casino in Wareham. Current state gaming law allows for a full-scale resort casino in southeastern Mass, but the law would need to be changed to allow the smaller facility proposed. The developer, the Nodos Group, is expected to release details of its plan today and meet with Wareham town leaders tonight. Mosquito spraying takes place tonight in the Orient Heights area of East Boston. Boston health officials say it's pre-scheduled spraying that happens every summer and is not in response to the two new human cases of Eastern equine encephalitis confirmed in southeastern and central Mass. Suffolk County Mosquito Control Superintendent Brian Farless says stay inside during the spraying.
It's always good to avoid pesticide exposure. Residents should go inside and they can close their windows and open them up half an hour after we spray.
The commission sprayed for mosquitoes in Hyde Park and West Roxbury last night. The demolition of the 90-year-old Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church in downtown Worcester is underway. Some residents and preservationists tried unsuccessfully to block the demolition of the church. The Worcester Telegram reports interior demolition is underway, with exterior demolition set for the end of the week. Sports tonight at Fenway Park. It's the Red Sox and the Philadelphia Phillies. The Sox have won five in a row. Traffic, 93 South and Andover. There's a crash in the active breakdown lane at 495. The Masspike eastbound is 20 minutes from Route 9 to 128, and then another 25 from there to the Prue Tunnel. Route 3 North is slow from Derby Street to the Braintree Split. Forecast, beautiful day today, sunny in the mid-80s in Boston and inland, just a few degrees cooler on the Cape and the Islands. It falls to the 60s tonight. Could be stormy tomorrow with showers and possible downpours and thunderstorms, low 80s tomorrow. Some sun on Thursday, but thunder is still possible in the 80s, then sunny, dry, and in the 70s, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. In Boston now, 74 degrees, 68 in Worcester, 69 in Lowell, and 73 degrees in Plymouth at 834.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by SBLI. Founded by Justice Louis Brandeis in 1907, SBLI is committed to providing families with straightforward life insurance. SBLI.com. Trader Joe's, where new products arrive in stores weekly, and new episodes of the podcast Inside Trader Joe's arrive online occasionally at Apple Podcasts and where podcasts are found. More at TraderJoe's.com. And Campaign Monitor, an email marketing platform used by more than 250,000 customers, offering personalization tools like engagement segments and dynamic content. More at CampaignMonitor.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King. Good morning. Planned Parenthood has left a federal government program called Title X. Title X gives money for family planning to clinics that serve low-income communities across this country. Planned Parenthood, of course, is one of the country's leading providers of reproductive health care, like STD testing, birth control, routine screenings, and abortions. But a rule change bars health providers from using Title X funds if they perform, talk about, or refer patients for abortions, with only a few exceptions. That's what's led to this split. Dr. Sarah Traxler is chief medical officer for Planned Parenthood's North Central States that covers Minnesota, the Dakotas, Iowa, and Nebraska. She's on the line from Minneapolis. Good morning, Dr. Traxler.
Good morning, Noelle.
So Planned Parenthood said it serves around 40% of Title X patients, or around 1.5 million people. How many of them are in your area?
So actually, in Minnesota, we see a higher number of that. About 90% of Title X patients are served by Planned Parenthood.
Wow.
And so we see quite a few of our patients through our Title X program.
Planned Parenthood will no longer be getting Title X funds. How much of your budget was coming from this form of funding?
A small percentage of our budget was coming from this funding, but it does actually serve about 53,000 patients in Minnesota and about 14,000 patients in Iowa. So it's a pretty big impact.
Okay. If it's a small percentage, though, does that mean you're not as worried as you might have been if it was a lot of money?
Oh, no. We're still worried because we believe that not having access to this funding will negatively impact our patients.
All right. So you obviously deal with a lot of patients, and many of them, given where you are in the country, are in rural areas. How will this affect them?
Well, I think one of the things that we see throughout the country is that rural areas tend to be underserved at baseline, and we see a lack of providers. We see folks in those areas who are underinsured or uninsured, and Planned Parenthood and the Title X clinics that we have out in our rural areas are often the only provider available to these patients. So patients who are unable to access Title X funds in those rural areas will be significantly impacted.
And what does that mean? They'll just have to drive much, much longer distances to find care?
They may have to drive further to get their birth control or their STI testing. I mean, we see that with abortion specifically. We see people who drive miles to access abortion. We may see people have to drive miles to access the birth control that they want.
Let's talk about what the administration is saying about this. Secretary Alex Azar of the Department of Health and Human Services said in a statement that Title X grantees, like Planned Parenthood, knew the rules before they accepted the funding, and that organizations are now, quote, abandoning their obligations to serve their patients under the program. What do you think about that statement?
Well, I would say that our obligation really is to serve our patients with accurate, reliable information, and that the Trump administration should not bully providers to compromise healthcare for grant funding.
I know this is a sensitive question, but given that most of the care that Planned Parenthood provides is not abortions, is there an argument that you shouldn't reject funding that really helps people get what they need?
I don't think that there is an argument. I think one of the things that we really need to think about is that Planned Parenthood has been around for over 100 years. We are known as a national expert that provides our patients with accurate, reliable sexual and reproductive health care. Our patients really trust us to give them the information that they're seeking that is accurate and true. So okay. I believe that we need to hold to that submitting to this gag rule is unethical and dangerous.
And just briefly, do you have a sense of where the money will come from if it's not coming from Title X?
I think we have a host of supporters and philanthropists who will support us. I also know that in some states, we're organizing insurance navigators who can help patients who are uninsured or underinsured get enrolled in programs, in the exchange, in the Affordable Care Act. There are ways forward.
Dr. Sarah Traxler, Chief Medical Officer for Planned Parenthood in the North Central States. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Protests do not always lead to change, but this one has. That's a crowd in Sacramento, California this past spring chanting the name of an unarmed black man killed by police. This after prosecutors announced the officers would not face charges. Protesters demanded a stronger legal standard for when police can use deadly force, and now they've got one. Here's more from Capitol Public Radio's Ben Adler.
Backers of the new law call it one of the strongest, if not the strongest, use of force standards in the country. And they say it's about time. The bill's author, Democratic Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, pointed to the different kind of justice applied to people of color.
After 400 years of demonstrating our commitment and our humanity to this nation, we deserve fairness and justice.
Weber has spent the last year fighting to increase California's deadly force standard from reasonable to necessary. It culminated in a compromise with law enforcement that passed the legislature with sweeping majorities. At a signing ceremony yesterday in Sacramento, on the day New York City fired the police officer whose chokehold led to the death of Eric Garner, California Governor Gavin Newsom said California is once again setting an example for the rest of the nation.
We are doing something today that stretches the boundaries of possibility. It sends a message to people all across this country that they can do more and they could do better to meet this moment in their respective states.
Joining Newsom on stage was the brother of Stephon Clark, who was killed by Sacramento police last year in his grandmother's backyard. Officers responding to a vandalism call thought Clark had a gun, but he was actually holding his cell phone. Stevante Clark acknowledged the law won't solve the entire problem, but said slow progress is better than no progress.
I call this the Stephon Clark law. You know, I don't think this law would be here and as powerful as it is now if it wasn't for my brother.
Law enforcement groups agree there's more work to do in officer training and in building trust. Here's Ronald Lawrence, the president of the California Police Chiefs Association.
As a society, that's what's going to make California and the nation better. You know, people need to trust their police and the police need to understand our communities, and we need to police our communities to the best ability of the expectation of our cities.
Lawrence praised a separate bill creating new officer training standards that's part of the deal, along with money in the state budget to pay for it. But it's clear this law only offers the opportunity to build that trust. Sacramento community activist Barry Axias says even though he fought hard to get this bill signed, he's not as optimistic as others about how it'll be executed.
Until there's some convictions and some firings, folks want to see that police are held to the highest regard just like anyone else.
Indeed, the signing ceremony was not entirely a kumbaya moment. The bill's backers did not invite law enforcement groups. Maybe emotions are still just a little too raw. For NPR News, I'm Ben Adler in Sacramento.
This is NPR News.
On 90.9 WBUR, thanks for tuning in. Coming up on Morning Edition, students worried about the move to close Roxbury Community College's nursing program. Now the forecast. WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein says it'll be a nice sunny day.
A weak frontal system passed through the area yesterday with a few showers and storms. That did usher in drier air. However, it's still pretty warm out there this afternoon with all the sunshine. We're in the mid to upper 80s. Tonight, the humidity slowly rolls back in. Temperatures down to the 60s, maybe a late night or early morning shower. Tomorrow, I think there's a period of showers and storms in the middle of the day. Not all of us see them, however. Low to mid 80s. We'll see a lot of clouds at that time. Some sunshine in the morning. On Thursday, a blend of clouds and sun. A couple of showers or storms. Temperatures will be in the mid 80s. Again, most of us missed those showers. And right now, the weekend's looking stunning. We'll start it out Friday, lots of sunshine, upper 70s. Saturday and Sunday, low humidity, mid to upper 70s. Plenty of sunshine both days.
In Boston now, 75 degrees.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Brigham Health, where doctors, nurses, and researchers work together to translate breakthrough science into leading-edge treatments. This relentless will to provide clinically excellent, compassionate care helps patients achieve the best possible health outcomes. Learn more at brighamhealth.org.
Now, Bostonomics business. Shares are up in Marlboro-based Boston Scientific after the medical device giant closed on its $4 billion acquisition of London-based BTG. BTG develops specialty pharmaceuticals and products used for cancer and vascular disease procedures. Suffolk University is seeking to buy a hotel in downtown Boston and convert it into a dorm for students. The school tells the Boston Globe it has an agreement in place to buy the Ames Hotel on Court Street and hopes to have students living there by the fall of 2020. This is WBUR. It's 844.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Plymouth Rock Assurance, presenting the Boston Bruins and TD Garden Auto Insurance Program. Bruins fans can learn more at plymouthrock.com/gobruins. And Essex Woods Meeting and Retreat Center for retreats, off-site meetings, and company outings in a natural setting, 45 minutes from Boston. EssexWoods.com.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes. Some former nursing students at Roxbury Community College are struggling to find their footing. That after a state board withdrew approval of the nursing program 2 months ago. The students tell WBUR's Carrie Young that finding another nursing program that fits their needs has been difficult.
Crystal Callender says she first heard the news from a group text message. She was in the middle of a biology class.
I was shocked. I was in shock, like, this can't be happening. The emotional roller coaster is terrible.
Callender is a single parent. She lives in Brockton and works full-time as a medical assistant. She says becoming a nurse was part of her life plan. Finish school, get a nursing job, then maybe one day buy a house.
There's not many programs for working people like myself that want to get their lives on a better track.
Which is why she says when she found the Roxbury Community College program, it felt like a good fit. It wasn't too far away from her home, and they offered evening and weekend classes.
They did tell you we're on warning, but it was just for not enough staff. But we're in the process of hiring. Oh, so for me, it was like, oh, this is great. Just staff? That's nothing.
Her fellow classmate laughed in agreement. Callender was a quarter of the way through the program when she learned she wouldn't be able to take classes there anymore. Officials with Roxbury Community College say they have always been transparent about their status with prospective students. A message about the State Board of Nursing's warning was posted on their application, and recruiters were instructed to disclose the information to every potential student. Still, the news took Callender and several of her classmates by surprise.
Now I feel like I'm at a standstill.
Callender says finding a new school has been a confusing process. While Roxbury officials did offer students the chance to meet one-on-one to talk about transfer options, Callender and fellow nursing student Janice Buziak-Smith says none of those felt like good options.
I was disappointed.
RCC leadership say they're working hard with area colleges to make the transition for impacted students easier. So far, four schools have agreed to work with the college to help this group of students transfer with as few roadblocks and as many credits as possible. But Buziak-Smith says they won't work for her.
I have a job, I have a small child, and I'm still paying student loans from my first degree. I said, we are in a two-year community college program, evening option, and you're giving us four-year private school day program transfer options.
But she adds, even if she did go with one of those options, she'd still be worried.
I want to make sure if I'm going to go to another evening community college option that it's not going to close.
Two of the schools that have transfer agreements with Roxbury Community College also have a history of issues with the state nursing board. Quincy College's nursing program lost approval last year and only recently got recertified. And while the Massachusetts College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences is in good standing now, it was also flagged with a warning back in 2017. Judith Perret, the director of education with the Massachusetts Nurses Association, recommends that if students want to avoid getting stuck in a limbo like this, they should consider schools like they do any big purchase.
You need to go on social media, you need to check websites, and you need to look at the reviews. Are there any board actions against that college?
In a written statement, officials with Roxbury Community College say fixing the issues raised by the Board of Registration in Nursing and regaining approval is a top priority. For student Crystal Callender, getting a nursing degree is still her top priority. She's planning to take some general education classes at Massasoit Community College before officially applying for their nursing program in 2020.
It's looking like the only option for me at this time. I'm just going to think positive and apply and see where I can go from there.
Her classmate, Janice Buziak-Smith, says for now, she's giving up on trying to be a nurse. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Carrie Young.
Carrie Young is part of our Edify team, reporting on education issues across the region. See the team's work by visiting the Edify page at our website, wbur.org.
Love NPR's Tiny Desk Concerts, maybe you know about the nationwide contest. This year, more than 250 musicians entered from Massachusetts alone. WBUR's panel of judges selected as their favorite Francis Forever's song, Space Girl. See the group live at City Space this Friday night with hip-hop artist All the Time Always. Co-presenters include WBUR's The Artery, plus WERS, Killer Boombox, and The Record Company. Details at wbur.org/cityspace.
Coming up on WBUR's Morning Edition, how many of the 2020 Democratic presidential candidates, including Senator Elizabeth Warren, are paying attention to Native American voters this year. Forecast, widespread sunshine today. It'll be in the 80s in Boston, inland, and on the shore. Tomorrow, we get clouds, maybe a thunderstorm and heavy rain in the 80s tomorrow. Partly sunny Thursday, but a thunderstorm remains possible, 80s again. Then Friday, Saturday, and Sunday look perfect. Sunny skies, low humidity in the 70s all 3 days. 75 degrees in Boston now at 8:51.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm David Green. President Trump seems to be backing off statements supporting gun control, including laws that would make it easier to take firearms away from people who might hurt themselves or others. 17 states and the District of Columbia have laws that make it possible to petition a judge to get what's called an extreme risk protection order. These are also known as red flag laws. And a newly published survey from the American Public Media Research Lab finds strong majorities of Americans from across the political spectrum support these laws. Joining us now is Lee Patterson from the Guns and America Reporting Project. She is based at member station KUNC in northern Colorado. Hi, Lee.
Good morning.
So I want to be careful here to clarify something. That this polling was done before the mass shootings in El Paso and in Dayton, Ohio, right?
Yes, exactly.
Well, tell us what you found here. What stands out?
Well, so before I just give you a bunch of numbers, the survey basically says that there's a lot of support for these laws. 77% of Americans support family-initiated extreme risk protection orders. 77%. And 70% support these orders when they're initiated by law enforcement. Polling shows support is strong among Democrats, Republicans, independents, though it's highest among Democrats. And it's fairly high among gun owners, too. 67% support orders initiated by family, and 60% support them when they are initiated by police.
Well, I know we have some tape that you collected from people you spoke to trying to, you know, understand the meaning of these numbers. I want our listeners to hear it. This is Cassandra Crafasi of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research.
It's not focused on all gun owners. It's focused on gun owners who are exhibiting risky behaviors that I think we can reasonably agree. Someone who's posting online about committing a mass shooting, or someone who's sharing with a family member or friend that they're thinking about harming themselves, that's someone that we would want to separate from firearms.
What does that tell us about the polling that you're seeing here?
Well, Crafasi, and just to add to what she just said, she pointed to the temporary component of these laws, and that's important because it means that once that temporary order expires, the subject of the order, the one who had to give up their guns, is able to go and ask for them back. I also talked with Amy Swearer from the conservative-leaning Heritage Foundation. She talks about these orders as kind of like an intermediate measure, meaning they can provide a way to intervene before someone has committed a crime or before they've gotten on the radar of mental health care professionals, but who maybe are already showing signs of dangerousness, as she puts it.
Well, I know we have some tape of Amy Swearer from the conservative-leaning Heritage Foundation also talking to you about why there is still, you know, notable opposition to ideas like this. Here's what she said.
There are legitimate, I think, underlying fears. If these laws are not properly narrowed, that if they're not using specific enough language, that if they're not being couched in appropriate measures of due process, that it can open the door for a lot of abuse.
And is that where the opposition comes from, the idea that a law like this could open the door for more?
Yeah. It's some of it. So some people believe these laws violate the Second Amendment because they limit access to guns. Others have concerns about due process. Here in Colorado, there's this whole movement of sheriffs who say they won't enforce the Colorado law once it takes effect because of the issues I've just outlined, because of that malicious intent idea. And also because the law just simply doesn't have a mental health care component.
Lee Patterson comes to us from Guns and America, a public media reporting project focused on the role of guns in American life. Lee, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
This week, issues important to Native American communities will get attention in a presidential election really like never before. 8 Democratic presidential candidates have signed up to attend a Native American voter forum in Sioux City, Iowa. Elizabeth Warren spoke there yesterday.
I know that I have made mistakes. I am sorry for harm I have caused. I have listened and I have learned a lot.
Elizabeth Warren there was apologizing for her past claims of Native ancestry, which upset many Native Americans and made her a target of ridicule for President Trump. Mark Trahant is editor of the news website Indian Country Today. He's been covering the forum and joins me. Mark, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
And we should say you're also emceeing the forum, right? You're doing some double duty.
Yeah, I'm the moderator.
All right. Well, can you tell me what it feels like? I mean, 8 presidential candidates coming to speak there. Is this really different in terms of turnout, in terms of tone from the past?
Well, certainly it elevates Native American issues to a level that just hasn't been part of the conversation before. Instead of having candidates do their normal stump speech, they're really forced to address things that don't get talked about very much, like treaty rights and the role of the Indian health system and that sort of thing.
Dig into some of those issues a little more, if you can, and help me understand what is really important to a lot of voters who come to a forum like this.
Sure. There are some 500-plus tribal governments that have a history that predates the United States, and many of those tribes have direct treaties with the United States that have responsibilities. And every Congress and every president talks about the role of treaties, but very few have actually said this is what needs to happen in order to have the treaties executed fully, including, for example, full funding of the Indian health system. It's the only direct federal system for healthcare in this country. And in many ways, when you talk about Medicare for All or something like that, looking at the Indian Health Service would be an example of how to do it right and how to do it wrong, what works and what needs work.
What has the record of the Trump administration been on issues like this so far? And, you know, how in general has the president done among Native American voters?
Well, to put it in a bigger context, the Obama administration kind of reached new heights. They started a tribal nations conference that happened every year and had direct consultation with the tribes in a way that was unprecedented. And so they set the bar really high, and the Trump administration has rolled back most of that and either not done the same sort of level of discourse with tribes or just ignore tribes. Where the Trump administration has put most of its energy is into resource extraction issues and working with the tribes that have coal and oil, for example.
What was that Elizabeth Warren moment like yesterday?
It was pretty extraordinary. One of the things with the Elizabeth Warren story that I don't think every time she appears before a Native group, she has made similar apologies. But more important, she gets an amazing reception. She was basically surrounded everywhere she went at the forum and received a standing ovation. And so there is a group that really is concerned about her statements in the past. But among both tribal leaders and people that she's out and about in a broader sense, it's just the opposite. She was one of the, we had a quote from a young man who said, clearly she was our favorite.
All right. Mark Trahan, editor of the news website Indian Country Today, also emceeing the two-day Native American presidential forum that's taking place this week. Thanks so much.
Happy to do it.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Forecast sunny, a little less humid today. High temperatures in the mid-80s, low 80s on the shore and on the Cape and the islands. In Boston now, 75 degrees. If you have a car or a boat you're thinking about replacing, consider giving it new life by donating it to WBUR. The station will get top dollar for it to support the news, and you could get a tax deduction. Learn more at WBUR.org/cars, and thanks very much.
I'm Nancy Cordes. Coming up today on Point, Congress considers taking up new gun violence measures in September. We'll look at the options and at gun laws states are passing on their own. Plus, SOS for MOM. And Dad, how to nurture your child by caring for yourself. That's On Point this morning from 10 to noon on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston,
92.7 WBUA Tisbury,
89.1 WBUH Brewster,
streaming at WBUR.org,
and live at City Space, Boston's new home for public conversation.
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.